Welcome back to MiningPod. Today, we're excited to launch the first MiningPod Takeover. We're two experts in the Bitcoin mining landscape. Takeover as hosts, interviewing others within their own domain. We have Taylor Monick from CleanSpark and Mark Fraza of Vinesh taking over the podcast for five episodes with guests from Galaxy Digital, Bitfarms, GDA, and Core Scientific, and then finishing off with an episode between themselves, just talking about what they learned during the mini-series, some highlights and what they're looking forward towards in the future. This is a really great show format. I learned a ton from just listening to these experts. It's kind of like closed-door conversations that you'd get if you're working in the industry. This is some of the top experts in the field. So thank you again to Taylor and Mark for spending the time going through these episodes and creating it. And thank you also to our guests for joining us. Last thank you to Forman Mining for being the exclusive sponsor for this mini-series. We'll have the normal episodes coming out on Wednesdays and Saturdays per normal, but we'll have these shows with Forman Mining coming out on Mondays going through the end of the year. Okay, first, a quick word from our sponsor, Forman Mining, and then we will jump right into the show. Hey listeners, if you're in the mining game, you'll want to hear about Forman. It's not just a management tool, it's a game changer for how you run your operation. Their dashboard isn't just about management, it's about smart automation for price avoidance and demand response with a strong energy strategy. This means lower costs and higher efficiency, giving you an edge in a competitive market. They grow and scale with you, providing an intuitive inventory management system that makes tracking your assets a breeze. Forman's automation works around the clock, ensuring your business is humming even while you sleep. It's about maximizing profitability with peace of mind. And Forman doesn't just help you save money, it pays for itself. Head over to Forman.mn to see what they can do for you. Whether it's optimizing energy, expanding capabilities, or streamlining operations, Forman can be the solution you've been searching for. With Forman, you're not just managing a mining operation, you're setting a new standard in the mining industry.
Welcome to the Mining Podcast Takeover. So we're going to be having a five or six episode series where Mark and I focus on immersion in technology and operations inside of the Bitcoin mining space. So my name is Taylor Monick, Senior Vice President of Mining over at CleanSpark, and I'll hand it over to Mark to do an intro on himself.
Hi, I'm Mark Fraza. I'm the head of BD for the Vinesh, our ASIC-TO, whatever you want to call us, in the firmware space. And we have our lovely guest here today, Ben.
Everyone, welcome. I'm Ben Gagnon, Chief Mining Officer of Bitfarms, also known as Hash Override.
Hash Override to the show. We're going to go ahead and jump right into it. So your title is Chief Mining Officer. Walk our guests through what your day-to-day or maybe week-to-week is being the chief mining officer over at Bitfarms.
Yeah, you know, the daily responsibilities of a chief mining officer change on a daily basis. You know, from a high-level view, I'm in charge of mining operations and strategy. So spend a lot of my day doing economic modeling, research, planning. But, you know, we also tie into just about every aspect of the company. So I engage with finance and capital raises. I work with investor relations to make sure our metrics are reported properly and the strengths and our accomplishments are communicated. Also work with the techs and the op guys, you know, to make sure that everything's working on the ground, understand their problems and different solutions that we can implement to make things better. So I spend a lot of my time on optimizing our sites and our assets.
No, that's awesome. Thank you for the recap. And one of the reasons I'm really excited to start the series off with Ben is Ben is been there, done that, has all the experience in the mining safe space from start to finish. Would consider him absolutely one of our leading experts when it comes to mining and running a mining operation. So we're really excited to have him. You know, over at Bitfarms, you know, you guys are focused on a wide range of technologies. Are you guys starting to implement liquid immersion cooling or hydro cooling or any sort of just alternative cooling mediums like throughout your guys' sites? Talk to us about how you guys view that in the development of it.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, a lot of people have gotten into immersion in a pretty heavy way. I have a background in two-phase immersion, as you know, Taylor. So we did run a little bit of single-phase immersion as pilot projects. So we had a small R&D project in Quebec, and we also had a small R&D project in Washington with single phase immersion. You know, my experience and my take on immersion, generally speaking, is that the system's already generally expensive and more expensive than air, and so people try and cut costs in every which way that they can to make the system more competitive. And I think when most people cut costs, it ends up compromising the performance of the system. And, you know, the way that you design a proper immersion cooled setup, whether it's single phase, two phase, or hydro, you really want to overbuild on the cooling capacity so that you can take of these miners up and down. And I think everybody kind of, you know, ends up with a kind of a half thought out product because they don't build in enough overclocking and cooling capacity. And so then they end up getting a lot of underperformance and higher costs as a result. I think that's been our experience with single phase immersion. So we are now starting to try out hydro cooled miners. I have a lot more hope and confidence in the hydro mining technology than I do over the immersion, just given our experience with immersion so far. Like, this is a product that's relatively simple, relatively easy to understand from our tech's perspective. And again, is much more modular, right? In terms of how it's built and how it plugs into a system. So we'll have our first 1 megawatt worth of hydro miners deployed here in the next couple of months in Quebec. And then we're deploying 20 megawatts worth of hydro miners down in Paraguay, all micro BT M56S plus variants, or is that the M53S plus variants?
So hey, we were kind of talking about this prior, and we had this conversation, I think, years ago when we were on a call. Yeah, you seem to know quite a bit about immersion, single phase, two phase. Could you elaborate on that project that you were working on? I can't even tell you how long ago it was.
Yeah, I got into two phase immersion right after I left China. I mean, if people know my background, I started out mining in mainland China back in 2015. I did that for a couple of years before it got simply too difficult for a white guy running a Bitcoin mine in mainland China. And so I had to shut everything down. When I did that, I transitioned off into a hardware manufacturing business that was trying to solve my greatest problem I had as an operator in mainland China, besides just being in mainland China, which was cooling. I wasn't in a very advantageous spot. I was in Guangzhou, which is pretty southern. It's pretty humid. It's pretty tropical heat. And we always had issues with heat and overheating on the miners. And so I wanted to solve that. I looked out around on the internet for the best technologies out there, and immersion quickly came to the forefront as a technology that, you know, boasted a lot of potential gains. I looked at this as, hey, what is the most perfect environment that we could have for our compute? What would that look like? And it was immersion, I think was kind of my take on that. So there's two ways that you look at that. You're single phase and there's two phase. Like, I think about single phase as, you know, kind of like the 80-20 rule. Like, how do you get the vast majority of the benefits for a lower cost and kind of a simpler product, right? You can surely get more performance out of a two-phase system than a single-phase system, but the amount of extra cash you have to put into it, the amount of extra over-engineering and the quality that you have to build that system up to, it's not worth the extra cost for the extra gain. And so single-phase is probably going to win out between the two technologies. If it's designed properly and it's a perfect environment for your compute, like, you should get a lot more economic benefit out of it. I just don't think people design it robust enough.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with the point on cutting costs. I mean, I think we've seen that in a lot of the deployments, especially in Texas and some of the hotter areas where people try and get away with dry coolers rather than cooling towers being, you know, that reoccurring theme I see. What led you away from your two-phase endeavor, your two-phase project? Were you trying to get back into mining, lost interest? Like, what was, it sounded like it ended at some point. What was the catalyst for that end?
Yeah, well, I got out of my mining business at the end of 2017, which turned out to be a perfect timing to exit a hardware business. And I transitioned off into this mining business. You know, I was self-funded the entire time with the profits that we made from our mining business in the years prior. And, you know, really it was funding a startup with Bitcoin in a bear market over 2 years where you're trying to sell the most expensive product to people who have zero money. It was a good strategy. It was terrible timing. And if we would have done the exact same thing 2 years later, it would have been a very different business. But trying to sell a two-phase immersion product to a Bitcoin mining community in 2018 and 2019 was a losing game. You know, it would take 3-4 meetings to explain the product, the advantages, the technologies, the payments. And every single time we had that meeting, Bitcoin's down another $3,000. And, you know, by the time you have the fourth meeting and they get it, Bitcoin's gone from 15K to 8K. And, you know, nobody wants to do it anymore. The math's all changed. So we got really close several times. But, you know, that Bitcoin price volatility bit us. Like, we had one deal lined up. It was a Friday. We went in to go close on Monday. Bitcoin price ripped over the weekend. It was up like 35%. You know, all of my costs on the hardware side went up. The guy thought I was screwing him, you know, because we had a deal on Friday and the price was different on Monday. You know, it's a tough market.
If there's one thing the manufacturers are good at, is hiking up the price of miners the moment there's a good price swing. But
absolutely. Never miss an opportunity to raise the price of miners.
Oh, yeah. And then when it goes down, we'll just throw you a coupon. But the one thing I kind of want to touch on too, though, so you were doing two-phase, and that's not even common now. I mean, I'm trying to think, did anybody else really do two-phase in mining at scale, right? I mean...
No, what was it? Allied Control out of Hong Kong, the group that Bitfury bought, they have a 20-megawatt site in Tbilisi. That was the first major site at scale. And I don't know of any other one. There was Taylor's site down there in Texas. And besides that one and the Tbilisi site, I don't know of any actual large-scale two-phase mining deployment.
Yeah, I can back that up. Yeah, I mean, besides Ben, the only other people that ever deployed was Bitfury / Allied Controls, depending on what you want to call on timing. The site in Tbilisi, they did another one in Azure, another part of Azerbaijan that was actually even larger, 60 megawatts. But yeah, those are really the only two or three at scale providers. I know there's been some smaller projects, people like Rick Margerson, who's deployed a number of smaller tanks. But if we're going to talk multiple megawatts, yeah, I think those are about the only three operators who have done it.
Off of curiosity, do you guys know if the Georgian site, the Bitfury site, is still running? Because, I mean, that hardware has got to be pretty old now.
As far as I know, yeah, it's still in operation. I don't think Bitfury owns it anymore. I faintly recall that it was sold, but I believe it's still running, just different ownership.
And so, Ben, you mentioned you're deploying your first megawatt of hydro with those micro BT machines. Is this something you guys are doing for performance, for sustainability, environmental concerns? Like, what led you guys down the path of saying, hey, let's try hydro? You guys have been a very successful air-cooled operation, always one of the top, you know, Bitcoin per exahash, top hash rate utilization companies. What made the push to go, hey, we should check out liquid cooling in some sort of fashion?
I mean, it's a good question. I think several things went into that. One, you know, the manufacturers are pushing this technology pretty heavily. We saw a site down in Washington that's running Bitmain Hydro. It's probably the largest Bitmain Hydro site in the country that I know of, is in central Washington. The technology, you know, seemed to be working out fairly well. There is a drive always to improve efficiency so long as the cost effectiveness is there. And I think especially in a lot of our sites we operate in, like Quebec, there's a huge demand for heat. There's also a lot of political headwinds against Bitcoin mining specifically. And I think part of the reason why MicroBT and Bitmain develop these products is they want to change their classification as a power load from Bitcoin mining to heat, right? And if you change your classification from Bitcoin mining to primarily heat generation, you know, then you should open up whole new pockets of available electricity. You start tapping into all these kind of decarbonization programs, like, you know, Hydro-Québec is the largest, well, they're the, you know, provincial state-owned utility for Quebec that gives us all of our electricity. And they have decarbonization goals. You know, the real big sector in Hydro-Québec to decarbonize is heat and transport. Right. And so heat and transport are still the only ones that are done with nat gas and, you know, obviously petroleum, diesel. So any sort of electrification of heat is actually seen as a positive, whereas Bitcoin mining is generally seen as a negative. So we want to get our hands on this technology. If this is an efficient way for us to capture, recycle the heat, get some economic benefit out of it, and some you know, actual utility out of it, that's a positive for us in terms of reducing our costs and improving our profitability. So get hands on with it. I mean, part of the reason why we deployed in Paraguay is not because we see the commercial viability of the technology, but also because we want to test this technology in multiple environments. We have the infrastructure coming in Paraguay. And what was the most cost-effective way to deploy that was utilizing some credits that we already had with the manufacturer. So we got all of the investment into the MicroBT M53S Plus for our Paraguay site with credits that we already had with MicroBT. So it was a very capital efficient deployment because we didn't have to deploy cash on hand.
So one of the things I wanted to ask, so when deploying an air-cooled farm, you know, design and, you know, how you situate and build the farm is obviously a concern. And then with immersion, you know, there's a whole lot of things you need to do right. Otherwise, you'll have a bad immersion. Are you finding this at all with hydros, or are there any quirks with getting your hydros up and running? Like, I know in colder climates, turning on a hydro is not a simple process because it needs to be warm enough. Granted, in Paraguay, I don't think you're going to have winter, but is there any quirks you guys are running into with these hydro units?
Well, for sure. And you know, the hydro deployment in Quebec versus the hydro deployment in Paraguay are completely different deployments. And it's like, you know, it's the same miner, but at the end of the day, the technologies, the interconnects, like, you know, the different variables that we have to control for in the environment is 180 degrees different. You know, like in Paraguay, even if the power went out, we're never going to have an issue where that fluid will freeze. In, you know, the rare situation that happens in Quebec, like, we need to be prepared for that. The system needs to be able to handle an emergency freeze. Like, if that happens, like, these are engineering challenges that are, you know, completely different in the two different areas that we're deploying. We're working through all that. You know, MicroBT is really good at providing support, and, you know, they're fantastic engineers and hardware specialists. So we're working through all of that really closely with the MicroBT team. And so far, I don't think we've had any issue that seems unsurmountable. But definitely there are things that we are learning right now that we did not know, you know, when we started getting into this process a couple months ago. We still do expect to deploy everything on time, though. So, you know, nothing insurmountable, like I said. Taylor, are you guys buying hydros, or are you full immersion?
So we're actually like a mix, right? So we'll have built 200 megawatts this year, 50 over in Washington and 150 at our Sandersville location. Those are actually all air-cooled sites. We have a new passively cooled building design that we're really excited about. Pretty much provides a PUE of one, which is about, you know, the mecca for data center design, being able to operate without fans. But yeah, we are absolutely looking into immersion. We plan to deploy a lot more immersion into 24. And yeah, we'll certainly do some testing on the hydro. But, you know, given my background and the things that I've worked on in my past, I'm really, you know, bullish on open bath immersion. I find the hydros to be definitely good from the performance aspect, and the pricing is getting great because, as you said, the OEMs are working on that technology. But just the amount of, you know, water leak points built throughout the site, and then you're basically locked into that specific miner and that specific device. For open bath immersion, I can put M56 next to S21 next to Canon 12 or 14, you know, whatever, and be able to run them all in the same tank and multiple generations and things like that. So there's pros and cons to like all the technology. We just feel really comfortable with immersion, so we're going to keep pushing, especially on the single phase stuff, to your point, right? If it's designed well, 80-20 rule, it's pretty much covers everything you need now. And I think it'll be a while till we get to those two phase type densities. But, you know, you're deploying different technologies. You're in several different countries, right? How has the regulatory landscape for cryptocurrency mining evolved in your time over at Bitfarms? And is there something about South America that's just really inviting and why you guys are going down there?
Yeah. You know, when I joined the company, we were just in Quebec. You know, we weren't even spread out across Canada. We're in one province of Quebec and basically towns that were no more than a 45-minute drive away from each other. I think, you know, what we've seen is that the regulatory environment for Bitcoin miners is definitely unpredictable. and faces a lot of political headwinds, the more diversification that we can have, the better. So, you know, I was actually originally hired to help us broaden out our reach beyond Quebec and set up, another branch of Bitfarms out in Alberta or some other location, that would give us a little bit more flexibility. And those plans didn't work out, but, you know, we've expanded now into Washington. We have Paraguay and we have Argentina, and we look at it like a portfolio. We've got a portfolio of sites. We have a portfolio of power providers, of power prices, of hardware we're deploying at these sites. And we're just trying to manage risk and optimize assets across, you know, all these different, these areas. The regulatory has changed a lot. Like, you're not in Canada, Taylor, but, you know, we have a situation in Canada where we had the trucker protest last year, and it was like the exact timeline is not entirely clear, but it was something like February 4th, trucker protest, February 5th, hey, we're going to freeze bank accounts. February 6th, hey, we're using Bitcoin. February 7th, they dust off whatever legislation they had against Bitcoin, you know, sitting on the sides since 2018 and threw it at us, you know. So for the last year and a half, we've been engaging with Ottawa in a tax lobby coalition. We pulled together basically every major Bitcoin miner in Canada. All the publics are with us. Most of the smaller, you know, privates or medium scale privates, like, we have it. The one thing they've really done is unified the entire industry against the federal government's tax policies. So, good for them. We're not going away, and we're going to continue fighting this. But, you know, this is a really illogical, you know, position for us to be in. And, you know, they change the rules, and then it's up to you to fight them and prove that the rules are unjust, you know, and until you succeed in that, it's the effective law. So I think the best way for us forward is diversification as much as possible. Like, we'd like to rebalance our portfolio, you know, like United States, not enough representation, Quebec, maybe too much representation. I would love to get into Africa or Northern Europe, and have a greater varieties of jurisdictional, you know, regimes, because it's, you don't know what's going to happen. And I think Canada is a pretty dangerous place, to be honest with you, on a regulatory side.
And what do you find is the biggest risk, like, on the regulatory side? Like, what do you think could have the biggest impact on mining, whether it's in South America or Canada, that you've seen, you know, over the last year?
I think it's a tax on energy prices. I think that's the easiest one for them to put through. You know, they can just tax the energy price to make it uneconomical. And I think we'll continue to see pressure on that. You know, that's something that they can say, hey, here's this industry specific tariff, you know, or industry specific tax rate. And, you know, it doesn't impact anybody who's not in our space. It's a really easy political win, I think, for a lot of communities. And so I expect you're just going to see a lot more of that sort of behavior. You know, I gave a talk in Prague at the POW summit a couple of weeks ago on how not to mine. And it was 12 rules to guarantee failure. And one of my rules is, like, you should go someplace where you're actually wanted, because the best places to mine are actually going to want you there, right? They're going to see the economic benefit of you coming in there, doing the investment, bringing the jobs, creating the tax revenue. Like, they're going to want you there. I think this business is far too fast paced to go someplace and just, like, fight against people who don't understand our business, don't want you there, like, think Bitcoin is just for criminals. Like, you don't have time to convince those people. The industry is too fast.
So another question I had, this is a question that I actually haven't really heard anyone ask before. How does Bitfarms manage security, protect against potential cyber threats and attacks? And then I want to also follow that up with, do you guys change the default password on your miner?
How do we defend against cyber attacks on our mining infrastructure?
Is that a major concern? You probably can't even talk about it if there's been events, but, you know, you got lots of money and hardware.
It's like a digital attack is not a major concern for us. Like, I mean, obviously we've got some safeguards in place, but, like, I mean, play it out. Like, what happens? Like, it's okay. So somebody you know, breaks in, immediately reconfigures our miners across the site. They start mining somewhere else. Like, we know about that instantaneously. And we have people on site. We can immediately cut the internet connection, and, you know, we can immediately turn everything off. Like, I mean, what's the worst that can really happen? So we start losing a little bit of revenue while we wipe everything and get everything set back to factory stock. I'm not so concerned about that. Like, any attack is pretty minimal in terms of impact. Like, the greatest cost there is going to be opportunity cost for not mining while you're getting things repaired. But I doubt that they could do any significant damage. I mean, worst case scenario, if you play out, is like somebody hacks in and overclocks all your miners and draws too much power off your infrastructure. Like, that's the probably the worst case scenario, but I don't really see what they get out of that, right? Like,
I mean, I can tell you the worst that I've seen, and I've only seen it happen once in North America. I won't say what farm it happened to. It wasn't public, it was a small farm. But this is like the S9, S17 era, where there was like people were buying, you know, secondhand machines from China. So what people were doing was they were loading basically firmware viruses on the machines, ship them to your farm, you configure it, put your password in, and then it would worm. And it would go through a lot of farms, they don't segregate, like a local miner can't talk to another local miner, and it would worm throughout the farm. And there was two really, really good viruses. There was one that we coined the Night Switcher, which was relatively genius what it did. It basically, at like 2 in the morning, it'd look up where it is. It's about 2 in the morning, CG Miner would just stop reporting to any management software that it's working. It was throwing, you know, errors. And in that time period, it was mining to like NiceHash or any pool that you can mine to a solo address. And then, you know, a couple hours go by, it switches back, and it would just be random downtime. That one wasn't horrible. And then the other one we called, it was called Ant Build. That's what we named it. That one was bad. That one was essentially, it was a worm, and it corrupted the control board. So you couldn't boot from SD card. Like, there was nothing you could do to wipe it. But I've never seen that happen anywhere in North America. It was pretty, I don't want to say it was pretty common, but like in Eastern Europe and like Asia, we saw that quite a bit.
Back in the day, there was no security protections at all on hardware, right? Like, the S9s didn't used to have any security, like anything before an S9 had zero security on it. So it'd be pretty easy to, you know, flash anything you want on there and send it off, you know? Yeah.
I mean, they didn't even have secure boot, which, granted, secure boot is generally used to protect ourselves, and manufacturers use it to lock you out. But yeah, I mean the BeagleBone board has no security either, but at least Bitmain, you know, does signature checking and all this other fun stuff. But yeah, if you go back like S9 era or even earlier, it was an open computer, essentially.
And so, Ben, you mentioned the S9. For some of the new users, you know, that have came into the mining space from, you know, over the last few years, that's going to be something that is well before their time. And with your experience in mainland China starting mining so soon, like, how do you look at the future of ASICs, and especially like how they're designed, the form factors, people adopting for immersion and for hydro? Where do you see the future of ASICs going, not only from like a design perspective, but then how they're sold and marketed and things like that from your experience over the past, it sounds like, over 10 years of mining?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I keep saying that the miners are not really designed well for the kind of facilities that operate them. Right. The miners are optimized, and their design is optimized around like a commodity based trading market. Like, that's how they're optimized. Right. They're not designed to be like, hey, this is an efficient way to build out a data center. You would never, ever see AWS with like a Bitmain S9 style server being plugged on, you know, racks, and like it you would just never, ever see it. I think it's all based on trading, right? Like, I think Bitmain has identified a market here. Maybe all the manufacturers identified a market here that retail really loves, because, hey, my miner is the same as the CleanSpark miner, the Bitfarms miner, the Marathon miner, whatever. Like, I can compete directly with them. It's the same miner. I think they love that. So that part of the industry, I think, is going to be really difficult to change. Even though I think it probably should. Obviously, the trend is towards more and more power density as much as you can possibly get it. And I think the Desaway miner is probably the best designed miner that we've seen out in years. If you take a look at how they've actually done that work and put the thought process in, oh, hey, we're going to use cheaper chips. We're going to super underclock them. You can overclock them if you want. Like, it's a very, very smart design philosophy. I think you're going to see a lot more power density. I think you're going to see miners that are more optimally designed to operate in a range as opposed to at a fixed point, right? Like the fixed point operation days, I think, are over. I think you want a miner that operates in a range profitably, and that you can control that range. And so I think that's where the immersion and everything else can possibly, you know, come in and provide a lot of extra value. You know, if you're able to run a miner and overclock at 50-60% because the power prices have just gone down, and you want to monetize that lower power price, and you're able to, you know, increase your power consumption there, then the power price goes down and throttle back down. That's the future of every miner, is this kind of programmatic range of operation, and a huge amount of power density. But I think we're going to be revolved around these retail trading cards.
Just one thing I picked up on is you're talking about the form factor. Would you argue that the Bitfury design is a better design for a miner? You know, like the 6U-based dimension, trackable, sliding, sure, modular, upgradable. No one else does that, and it's kind of sad.
It was by far the best design. It was a really smart way to do it. And those things were tanks. Like, Hut 8 was running them until I think last year. They just don't break, you know. Like, they were really, really well designed air cooled units, and they were incredibly easy to service and maintain. So I love that form factor. I should think that more people will do that. When the S9 is really special to me. It was my first Bitmain ASIC that I actually had and operated. When I started, it was all S7s, and the S9s came out shortly after. Every single generation of miner generally has a huge increase in power consumption. Like, S7 to S9 was a huge increase. You started getting to S9 to S15s, it was like a moderate increase. You get to the 19s, we're at 3kW now, or the 17s and the 19s, you know, you're at 3kW. Now you're looking at the T21s have a high energy mode. So the T21s are designed to do between 3.6 and 5.2. Again, there's that range there that I think is kind of where things are all going. It's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger. I think we're going to move up to 480 volt, three phase PSUs. And I don't think any site's going to be operating at 240 in 5 years. Like, that'd be really surprising to me.
I think that the one issue, though, is, of course, when you design your farm, you design it. Think about all the farms that were designed around S9s. Then there was a push for 17 series and 19 series. The infrastructure updates that some farmers will have to take it's going to suck.
For sure. It's, you know, and that's the other thing. Again, like, I think people with air cooled farms, I think they're trying to save as much cost as possible. You're better off overbuilding a little bit, right? If you build in a little bit of flexibility into your farm, you might be able to save yourself a lot of cost later on. And I don't think people understand the benefits of that flexibility enough just yet.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to kind of go back to and nerd out for a moment here is you bring up DesiMiner and a little bit of how they design things differently. Would you mind digging in the details a little bit about that between the heat pipes on the heat sinks, like the heat pipe heat sink design, the different chip layout that they did and everything? Would you kind of just highlight some more detail around that just for people listening that might be interested, and how maybe it varies from a Bitmain miner, to keep it simple?
Yeah, like, if you take a look at a Bitmain miner or a MicroBT miner and you look at it without the heat sinks on, like, the first thing that you'll notice is the chip placement on the board. And the chip placement on the board is not uniform across the board. Like, it's highly concentrated on one end, and then it just gets less dense as you get further across the board. And the reason for that is because right at the front end where it's most dense is the closest to the air intake. It has the coolest air. As the air passes over, it's heating up. And so it's had less ability to cool those chips later on. If they were spread at the same density, you'd have an issue. you know, the way that Desaway designed their miner, they designed it to be able to handle a wide variety of temperatures. And part of the way that they did that was with the chip design itself. So by utilizing a chip and planning to underclock it significantly in order to get your desired performance, that means the total output on each one of those chips is already significantly less, right? And now your cooling requirements to operate at those normal underclock specs are significantly less on a chip basis, right? So they're able to do a little bit more flexible cooling with that. They also have better conductivity built into the heat sinks, right? Based on the way that they've designed the board layout and the heat sink layout. So you should have better thermal conductivity. You have a better philosophy, I think, with the chips. And you have a better design layout on the actual board itself. So you're able to push those chips quite a bit because they've designed the board to be pushed, right? It makes a lot of sense to me. Like that's how everything should be made. Like most of the, you know, most of the Bitmain miners, like you can push them pretty hard with Mark's, you know, software. But then they'll start hitting issues with temps, right? Like that's where the immersion comes in because they didn't design it properly. But that doesn't mean you can't design an air-cooled miner to be pushed, you know, and operate in a wide variety of energy consumption levels and heat generation. Like there's no reason why you can't do that. You can. Desaway did it.
Yeah, when I was actually down at the conference and I met with them, I was pretty blown away because, I mean, I went, of course, I nerded out and I was like, okay, what nanometer, what size is the die, and going through it. And then I was asking them, you know, how many cores? And they all paused and looked at me like, why is this dude asking us how many hashing cores are in each chip? I'm like, oh, what's the frequency? And they're like, okay, they're telling me. And I'm like, oh, I see what you did. And like, you're just putting less, like, from what I recall, I had the less, like, less than half the number of hashing cores as like a Bitmain model. And over far less than half the normal frequency. And then their power supply voltage range is so massive that they can go all over the place. I think the only downside to doing what they did is like it's a little bit, it's cheap and it's expensive. They're using older gen chips, but they're packing in so many. The only thing and I'm not aware of, and I really wish I asked at the time, is as you'll know with most Bitmain MicroBT miners, when a single chip, say, shorts out and burns up, the whole hashboard's dead because it's serialized. Something with that design, I'm curious if they added, you know, smaller series. So, like, let's say you
can't remember the chip sequencing on the Desaway board, but I wanted to say there was a couple of different parallel lines running. It wasn't all in one sequence. I think they had four. Pulling this off memory, I could be wrong. I think they had four different sequences. Like they had four different lines, and there was some sort of pass through. So you know, if you do have chip failure, it just passes through onto the next. There was some sort of
deal. Oh, they had essentially like a jumper that would jump it.
There was some sort of input output connector that even if the chip died, it would still relay the information onto the next chip. If I remember that correctly, it was pretty well designed.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking at it, I was, you know, first thing I did when they had a miner there, I took a piece of paper and I clogged the fans. And they're like, oh, look, it went up to 90C. And I was like, all right, let's do it.
Yeah, I think my biggest gripe is the miners manufacturers don't design the miners for the operators. They design them around retail trading. You know, like if you designed it a product for deployment at scale, it would not look like what we have. It would look radically different. The Desaway miner is the first miner that I've seen a long time that, you know, took a step back and was like, hey, if we just like started from scratch, could we design this better? And they designed a better miner. We'll see how well they do. New manufacturers, that's a really tough space to be in. But it's a really smart design philosophy, I think.
What would you want? Let's pretend you were building a miner. What would you want to do that would make it nicer for the operator? Make it a hardware level, it could be software level.
I think definitely all the miners need better firmware. Like you know, the way that we track our miners as a portfolio, we wanna know all the miners' individual cost information, their individual revenue, their individual profit, their individual cost to maintain. Like we wanna know all of that. A lot of that could be done in the individual miner firmware. And I think, you know, planning a miner for somewhere between like a 1.5 to 4 kW range. Like that would give people a lot of benefit. You know, way that the chips can be designed differently to have more of an exponential curve or less of an exponential curve in terms of performance. You know, I would like to see a machine that have a lot more greater flexibility.
And do you think any of the newer miner providers are making major progress on that? So we have Desi Miner, we have Chain Reaction, we have Aerodyne, a lot of new players, you know, coming into the space, some of which have deep Silicon Valley roots and developing some pretty amazing technology. Do you see any of those guys standing out from one another in this process? I know you highlighted Desi Miner, but didn't know if you've had the chance to work with Chain Reaction or Aerodyne or some of the other newer players in the market.
Yeah, I think the market's pretty ripe for disruption. I believe we're testing all of those miners. I think we're under MNDA on the other two though. So I can't get into too much, but like, you know, we're looking at all the miners. You know, if there's a new miner model out, we should have at least one of them, you know, just so that we understand what people are producing, what are the changes, like what should we expect, you know, like we should have at least one of every miner that comes out. And so that's, you know, part of that is just intel and knowing. I do think, you know, this is a very difficult game to be in. Like there's a reason why very few miners have gone the vertical path to building their own miners. It's a very competitive space. Like it's just very competitive. I've no desire to be in that space. And best of luck to anybody who wants to go at it. I think, you know, Bitmain with an 80 to 90% market share is like probably a pretty unsustainable number. And I think you have a lot of people trying to nip at that market share right now. We'll see what happens.
Wasn't there a miner, this is going back a couple of years, they were trying to make some altcoin miner and they raised a bunch of money, started doing production. And then I remember the developers claimed that Bitmain affected, you know, messed up their product line and basically told people who were selling parts for them to stop. And they did, and then Bitmain dropped an ASIC that did the same shitcoin algorithm. Does anyone know what I'm talking about?
I do not, but you know, it's crypto, man, and it's shitcoins specifically, so anything goes.
Yeah. my next question was, how do you see the relationship between traditional financial systems and cryptocurrencies evolving, and then how do you see Bitfarms, you know, like fitting in that landscape, and then on top of that, is do Virgin Bitcoins matter? Because they kind of all meld together.
Virgin Bitcoins don't matter. I think we all know that. There's no, like, there's, I've heard that since like 2018, that these Virgin Bitcoins are going to get a premium. I've never seen one of those deals. So I think that's a pretty easy question, nip in the butt. You know, it's a funny thing because it's like a chicken and the egg scenario with TradFi and Bitcoin specifically. I've always had the view that, you know, people like to look at Bitcoin as the most volatile asset because the price moves so rapidly and so quickly in a free market. But the truth is it's the most stable asset on the planet because we know exactly what supply exists at exactly any given point of time. Historically, and we can predict it with an incredible degree of accuracy any time in the future. And in fact, like the further out you go, the higher confidence you have at predicting that exact number, because you're going to lose out on the randomness and the variability over a greater period of time. Like it's actually pretty mind-boggling, the mathematics around the predictability of Bitcoin supply. And so when traditional finance starts realizing, like, wait a minute, there's actually a traditional like fixed unit of supply that we can predict out over time that's not, it doesn't vary according to anything, like I think that's the real value here. You know, nobody can tell you how many dollars exist today or how many are being printed. Nobody can tell you how many barrels of oil exist or how many are being pulled out of the ground or how many are being consumed. Like nobody can tell you that for any commodity. The only commodity on the planet that anybody can say that with for certainty, and everybody can say that with certainty, and everybody can check everybody else's numbers with certainty, you know, is Bitcoin. It's the only one. And I think that's an incredible asset. When people realize that, TradFi is going to be all over this pricing things in Bitcoin. And I think it's inevitable personally, but certainly not there tomorrow.
I guess on that note, do you think there's going to be a day when, like, or do you, how am I going to word this? Do you ever think there's going to be a point in time where, like, Bitcoin will be like a dollar, or will it still be more like a digital gold?
You know,
like, will I be able to walk into a car dealership and buy a car with Bitcoin, or buy my version with Bitcoin in the U.S.?
I think that's absolutely going to happen. I think that that already exists. You know, like, there's a lot of places where you can do that. It's, you're paying in Bitcoin, but it's settled on MasterCard or, you know, something along those lines. Like, that that exists. I think that will keep getting bigger and better. I think the rails are there. I think Lambo accepted like 2 weeks ago, or Lambo or Ferrari started accepting Bitcoin. It was Ferrari started accepting Bitcoin for payments. You know, like, maybe it's a LARP, but maybe there are a decent amount of Bitcoin bros who are like, yeah, get me a Ferrari. I want to pay in Bitcoin. I do not want to pay in cash. Right. Yeah. I mean, payment rails are a big thing. I think that's the, like, if you look at, if you're into equities, and you know, Taylor and I are public markets. So I'm sure we look at those quite a bit, but like Visa and MasterCard are like two of the most amazing stocks of like all time. You know, they've got a monopoly space on payment processing, and they just clip a percentage of what the day, you know, what the daily transactions are every single day around the world, like nonstop. That needs to be disrupted, and Bitcoin can be really good at disrupting that space. You know, you need other vendors in there, like Cash App and other things who are going to provide the rails. But like, that's a marketplace that's, it's massive and desperately needs disruption. The credit card space.
That ties into my next question, right? And it's two part. You've been in this space forever, so I feel like you're a good person to ask this to. What do you think is the next big adoption moment? Like, what is the next moment in time where, you know, let's rule out the ETF because everybody's talking about it. But after the ETF, what's like the next big thing in Bitcoin? Is it accessibility to wallets that are really easy to use? Is it a tie-in with a certain system? What's going to be the next catalyst for that next stage in adoption where we'll see more than just one car company accepting Bitcoin, but multiple?
I think it's going to be geopolitical. I think Bitcoin's primary focus is to kind of address these geopolitical issues, and the world is crazy and getting increasingly crazier and more chaotic by the day. I think governments are going to have harsher and harsher reactions to capital controls, freedom of movement, freedom of money movement. And I think Bitcoin's going to be there to start absorbing all of this. Like, unfortunately, I think the biggest driver for Bitcoin adoption is geopolitical instability. And the areas where we see Bitcoin really thriving, and some of the periods where we've seen Bitcoin really thriving, are in those areas. Like, I'm not sure if anybody remembers back in 2017, I think it was Greece freezed all the banks and all the ATMs. Bitcoin went nuts. Like, Bitcoin went nuts during that period. And it was because it was like, for them, it was like their only way. It was their only way out. Like, I'm not sure if anybody, you know, pays attention back to Ethereum back in China back in 2017, but in January 2017, I was in mainland China, and they announced a new rule saying that you can't withdraw cryptocurrency from a Chinese exchange. So as before, what people were doing was they're sending RMB to a Chinese cryptocurrency exchange, they're buying Bitcoin, they're withdrawing it to a foreign exchange, they're selling it there for USD or Euro or whatever that is, and they're getting around the capital controls because you can only send out $50,000 a year as a Chinese citizen without having any problems. And so they're just using Bitcoin. And the government in January said, we're going to stop this. But they only stopped it for like the top four or five cryptocurrencies. And so it was like Bitcoin, Litecoin, whatever two other crap coins there was. And then Ethereum was the next one on that list. And Ethereum like immediately starts trading up. Like, Ethereum was at like $10 and then 11 the next day, and like 12 and 14, and went all the way up to $430, like starting the day that China made that announcement. And it was a real world utility. Like, Chinese were using it to get their money out. And when he absorbed all that from Bitcoin into Ethereum, it drove the price. And everybody in the West was like, oh, dApps. And it was like, no, it's like, this is like, this is Chinese policy. You know, driving this 40% or, you know, 40x rally. I think it's all geopolitical. It's more instability in the Middle East, higher oil prices, like more sanctions on countries, you know, restricting their ability to trade. Like, the more countries cut each other off, the more people are going to use Bitcoin to reconnect and, you know, establish new networks.
Another question I had for you, since you've been in the mining space professionally for 2015, like 8 or 9 years, what, you know, personal or professional lessons have you learned from this industry that you think should be shared?
No, I mean, and I think it's a really big point to point out. I mean, you've been in this industry a really long time. I like to make the joke that Bitcoin mining is kind of revolving doors of 2 years. So maybe tie in, like, how have you been here for 10 years and been so successful, you know, throughout this time frame?
I think that might not be as much of a compliment as you think, you know, to say, hey, you've been here 9 years and you're still here. You know, obviously, I've made some mistakes if I'm still here after 9 years instead of rotating out after,
you didn't huddle?
After 3 or 4. But no, I mean, I think everybody likes to chase in this market, and the real way to play is countercyclically. You know, it's the same as any other market. You don't want to be doing what everybody else is doing. You want to be doing the opposite of what everybody else is doing, I think. And so that's a challenging spot, you know, like. I say most people probably get into mining with for the wrong reasons. Maybe they didn't do the math. They've got lofty expectations that are not realistic. And, you know, they think that, hey, I'll just plug in 10 computers and they're just going to run forever. And I'm just going to make all this money. And like, I don't have to do anything. It's like, no, that's not how any of this works, you know? And my biggest advice is, unless you're like super passionate and nerdy and like want to learn about this stuff, like don't even bother with it at all. Like if you're somebody who wants to plug in one S19 and you're not very technical and you want to maintain it, like just like don't do it. it's probably not worth it. If you're somebody who wants to tinker around and like figure out a way to heat their hot tub, like by all means, like buy an S19 or whatever and figure it out. For most people, this is not the space you want to be in. Like, it's just not the space. Like, I don't know how many nights of rest that I've given up on because I'm sitting there with my Bitcoin mine and, you know, I've got like 38 machines down and I'm running the math and I'm like, oh shit, if I go to bed tonight, it's going to cost me $750 to sleep. And then, you know, then I was like, well, I'm not sleeping right now until these miners are back up. And, you know, most of my advice would be like, don't do it.
Got it. So advice is don't do it. No, but I agree, because
you have to really love this space to do it. Like, don't get in this as like just a curiosity.
Well, no, I'm just thinking like back 2017, I had like 30 or 40 ASICs and I've told this story so many times in like my parents' basement. You know, it's snowing outside. The grass is growing because of all the heat coming out. And it was, you know, here I am in the middle of winter trying to like mitigate heat problems. And, you know, Bitcoin's going to the all time high, you know, an S9 was making a couple hundred bucks a day. It was the first batch, you know, and that was literally my dilemma. I called out of work the next day. I mean, that's what I did. I just stayed up all night and, you know, I just said I was sick, but like, how are you going to be like, yeah, I was playing with my Bitcoin miners trying to make more money. It doesn't computate, but,
And on that note, like, you have to be passionate about it, right? Clearly you're passionate about it. You run one of the largest mines in the world. Talk to us a little bit about like how you got into Bitcoin. I've never heard the Ben intro to Bitcoin story, which I assume means a lot of people haven't. Like, you lived in mainland China, you've been mining for 10 years. What was the original like orange pill moment, or where did you find out about it? Or what dragged you into this horrible industry that you speak so highly of?
Yeah. So I was in college in 2010, and I was using this forum called endoftheinter.net, and it was a place where people could trade games and movies and everything else, and they were using Bitcoin to buy and sell movies and games. I had a friend who was mining Bitcoin on his gaming PC in his frat, and he was just selling it for beer money. It was like 73 cents at the time, something like that. And he wanted to sell like $100 to buy Bitcoin, to buy beer. And my friend and I were going to split $100 worth of Bitcoin at 73 cents. And we're like, you know what? Like, this is super cool. We've seen it on our forum. Like, you know, we can get some of this Bitcoin thing. We're like, what can we do with it? Like, the only place we've ever seen anybody use it is on this like illegal forum where people are trading games and movies illegally. And I said, maybe we're getting screwed here because this guy is using it to buy beer money, and we could also use the beer money. And so instead of buying $100 worth of Bitcoin at 73 cents, we went out to go buy $100 worth of Pabst Blue Ribbon because that was our favorite college beer of choice. And we got to the grocery store and they didn't even have Pabst Blue Ribbon. They only had Pabst Blue Ribbon Light. So we bought $100 of Pabst Blue Ribbon Light. And then about a year later, I saw the price of Bitcoin was at $1,200. And I said, shit, for that, for those like couple of cases of Pabst Blue Ribbon Light, could have had over $1,000,000. And ever since then, I've been hooked on the Bitcoin price and watching the charts and the technology. I tried buying miners from Butterfly Labs in 2013. I sent them $5,000. I'm still waiting on my class action lawsuit to pay out. They never sent me my miners. I bought my first Bitcoins in an ATM in 2014, and I paid like a 6%, you know, fee, and everybody thought I was crazy, but Bitcoin was like $400. And then I started mining in with Ethereum in 2015. So Ethereum came out. My boss at the time, I worked for a really small web development company in Hong Kong. My boss went to DevCon in London, came back like 3 days later and was like, guys, I quit. Like, this is your company. What do you mean you quit? It's like 6-person web development company and you're the CEO and lead, you know, software engineer. He got a job at the first ICO on Ethereum, a company called Digix. And they were doing like a gold-backed stable coin out of Singapore, tokenized gold with the bank of the gold vault of Singapore. So you go there, you give them your token, you get a gram of gold. So he got a great deal on that. And I looked at it, I said, this is Bitcoin 2.0. I'm not going to do my Pabst Blue Ribbon Light moment all over again. I went out, threw an Ethereum miner on my gaming PC. I just ran it for a couple of days, saw that it was working, came up with a plan. I bought every GPU I could in Hong Kong, packed them into suitcases, moved out to Taiwan, built a GPU mine in my girlfriend's mom's house in Taiwan, and I ran it there. Had some issues because they thought we were growing weed because we were consuming too much power for a residence. So we were getting like weekly police checks. Just make sure we're still not growing weed. No, it's still the same computers as last week. Then I moved that into mainland China. So, you know, I saw Ethereum. I said I wasn't going to miss the boat a second time. And, you know, I started out as an F Maxi in the, then there was the Ether Classic fork. And I was on the Ether Classic side. I thought, you know, we would win. We lost really hard. It was a really bad decision. I lost a lot of money on that call. And I realized like how important Bitcoin was, you know, because they don't play these kind of games and there's no like demigod in charge. And I realized how valuable not having a demigod in charge of your cryptocurrency was. And I slowly started becoming a maximalist.
I guess, and then the last question, where do you see the future of Bitfarms? I mean, you're building out these sites. Is there anything that you could talk about that you guys are planning for the future?
You know, I think the way that we look at the company is a little bit different. You know, when you look at how Bitcoin miners came out as public companies, like it was kind of a workaround for the lack of a spot ETF and the lack of ability to get a spot ETF. So when miners first came out in 2017 and 2018, we were a loophole to get Bitcoin on, you know, a public vehicle. Hey, you're like less risky. You don't have customers. You're not dealing with deposits. You're just processing this. You're receiving it. You're selling it. Like, we were a workaround. And I think, you know, as we look towards the future, what we really need to be cognizant of is like that we are a company that, you know, is designed to provide exposure to Bitcoin to our shareholders. And, you know, there's lots of different ways that we can provide that exposure. The question is like, how can we provide better quality exposure to our investors, you know, that give them more upside for less risk or more upside for less cost? I think we're taking a look at that question very deeply. Like, how do we provide better quality exposure for our investors over and over and over again? And so when you look at like a future Bitfarms, you know, what will it look like? I mean, I think it's going to be more diversified. I think it's going to have a very strong portfolio management, you know, framework. for how we manage all of our sites. I think there's, you know, there's room for a lot of different areas of this mining business, I think, in a good portfolio. And I think we'd like to provide exposure to a greater variety of the mining ecosystem, as opposed to just, you know, staying purely focused as a one-trick pony and just buying new miners and plugging them in all the time.
So you talked a little bit about diversification being a little bit different. I'm going to ask the age-old question right now. Does AI, does HPC fit into Bitfarms' future business models, or are you guys strictly looking at focusing on the Bitcoin side of the technology world?
You know, I think it takes advantage or utilizes a lot of our core competencies as a good developer and operator of high-quality megawatts and infrastructure. There's certainly something that we could do there. It certainly is a very different space that, you know, we would have to learn a lot from. And I think when you look at just kind of the CapEx of it, it doesn't actually necessarily make a ton of sense given how much money you have to spend to deploy a megawatt of HPC or AI. Like, sure, the revenues are huge, but the levels of capital expenditure relative to the size of most mining companies to deploy that equipment is phenomenally unbalanced. You know, if you're a 200 megawatt mining company and you want to deploy, let's say 20 megawatts worth of HPC, like, and you're trying to do it with the latest gen stuff, like, you do not, there's no way you have the money for that. Like, there's just the relative scale of 200 megawatts worth of mining versus 20 megawatts of HPC in terms of the capital costs. And it's radically different.
Go in detail there. Why don't you give the listeners like a little bit of what's 1 megawatt of HPC? Just ballpark it for them so they can understand maybe a little bit of the difference between buying a 1 megawatt of S21s versus buying 1 megawatt of an H100 GPU type clustered setup.
It really depends on, you know, what you're deploying. But I think on the high end, you could easily spend $30 to $40 million for a megawatt of you know, H100 high end GPUs. Like, if you want the best compute, I think 30 to 40 megawatts is probably what you're spending, $30-$40 million a megawatt. You know, and if you look at what would it cost us to deploy a megawatt of mining, you know, 30 to 40 times less than that, you know, like it's much closer to a million than it is to 30 or 40. You know, obviously a lot of different technology that you can use to deploy that megawatt of mining and different models and everything else, but like, it's nowhere close to 40 million, even with the best possible gear you can imagine in mining. You're not getting close to 20 million a megawatt. You're not getting close to $10 million a megawatt.
No, yeah, I couldn't agree more. The costs are wildly different. And if you look at a tier 3, tier 4 data center compared to a typical Bitcoin mine, while they are the same
different
theory, they're completely different, right? Yeah. They're two different worlds of thought from design and practice and everything like that. So yeah, no, it's interesting to hear how the AI and HPC space is converging with the typical mining space. But it is also awesome to learn from each other, right? I think that the data center operators can learn a lot from the miners. I think the miners can learn a lot from the data center operators. So that could be an interesting trade of information over the next few years.
I think we'll definitely do it cheaper. I think that's for sure. Like, you know, a miner is going to figure out a way to deliver that compute for less money. That's what we're really good at as miners is, if you're a good miner, you should be really good at controlling costs. Because it's the only thing that we can control, right? We can't control our revenue. So if we're not in control of our costs, like, we're not in control of anything at all. I think we could find a way to do it cheaper. I'm still really interested what's going to happen in this space. You know, it's really new. And I think there's a lot of risk in spending $40,000 for a GPU. You know, just like there's a lot of risk in spending a lot of money for an ASIC, you know, especially for a brand new one, like I think there can be a lot of risk depending on when you buy them in the cycle, right? And the AI thing is so new, we have no idea what a cycle is, you know, like we're at like this thing could go on huge, this thing could stop tomorrow, like there is no cycle that can be identified. And so it's a very speculative bet on the value of that compute, which I honestly think HPC is more risky than Bitcoin mining right now.
Yeah, definitely wonder how long it's going to last. So the cycle concept is something that is particularly interesting in my mind.
The one thing I was just thinking of, though, that was kind of funny, I'm just imagining if a Bitcoin miner did cooling for like a server cluster, I'm just picturing a bunch of server racks and it's a big swab cooler in front of it with a screen. That'll do.
Hey, it might. It might, Mark. It just might do.
I mean, it might just do.
7.9's of reliability right there. Just a swamp cooler in front of some NVIDIA DGXs. Apparently, that's the secret answer that Equinox and the other companies have figured out.
Yeah, you just sell it every year.
Why doesn't AWS use cardboard wet walls? Like, why doesn't AWS do that?
Yeah, they should. They just sell them every year. I'm used.
Well, Ben, we really appreciate you coming on. Great way to start the first episode of this takeover to have somebody like yourself on. So best of luck to you and Bitfarms, and we'll see you on the flip side.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
See you.